We're continuing our series in Matthew 5 through 7, the Sermon on the Mount today. And we're entering into the Lord's Prayer. The Lord's Prayer is probably the most famous, well, it's definitely the most famous prayer in human history. In fact, they say that, like, it is the most said paragraph that humans have ever spoken. So in all of history, every religion, all the poetry, all the different languages, all of the different cultures and peoples, the Lord's Prayer has been said more than anything else by human beings. Now, for some of us, that's actually kind of a bad thing. Some of us grew up in a tradition where we just said the Lord's Prayer over and over and over again, and it started to lose its meaning. It started to, like, it's just like rote, it's a mantra. You're not thinking about it, you're just doing it. It's just happening. For some of us, we didn't say the Lord's Prayer at all. I memorized it when I was a kid, but I never really thought anything about it, except maybe it was like a pattern for praying. Like, you might have heard the Acts thing, the adoration, confession, thanksgiving, supplication, that it's like a pattern that we use. And so we never really use it, we never really pray it, we're just aware of it. Well, I think that there should be like a middle ground. I think that there is a place for us to be using the Lord's Prayer, but we have to do it in a way that we're conscious of the depth of its meaning. And so when I say we're starting the Lord's Prayer today, I mean that quite literally. We are only going to look at one verse, because I think that there's a whole bunch of stuff that's in the Lord's Prayer that we're missing. And it's a call to us about how to live in the world, how to act in the world, and the way that God sees us moving forward. So let's start with, and I almost never do this, but I'm using the traditional old King Jamesy Anglican version of the Lord's Prayer. It's the one I memorized as a kid. If you're new to faith and you've never heard the Lord's Prayer, this is going to sound a little weird because there's these and thous and thines. But it is sacred, and it's mattered a lot to many people over the millennial, the hundreds of years since the English translation came. And so if you want, you can even say it with me if you know it. But this then is how you should pray. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive those who debt against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever and ever. Amen. I have that last bit in brackets because that was actually added to the Lord's Prayer much later on during the medieval period. So it wasn't in the original text, but it's such a beautiful way to end the prayer. I think it's worth affirming that. And if that's weird for you, I'm gonna say that Jesus didn't say that. That was added later. And if that's weird for you, and you're like, oh, what do I do with that? Come talk to me. Because if you look at modern translations, they don't have that bit. But it's so beautiful. And that's one of the things that's amazing about the Lord's Prayer. It's like, it's poetry. It's gorgeous in the way that it's so simple and so succinct and yet so theologically fraught. And so let's start with just the first verse of the Lord's Prayer. Our Father who art in heaven. Our Father. Now, if you've noticed the way I pray, up here when I pray, I always start the same way. I say, gracious God and Father, right? And if you've been a Christian for any time, or you've just been around Christians, this is old hat, right? Father, Father, Father. Yes, he's our Father. We're his children. Not literally, because God didn't, get married and have children. But he sees himself as our Father, and we know that. But that's weird. That's weird in Jesus' day. Okay, in Jesus' day, that would not have been the case. Why? Well, I got a painting here by Domenico Fetti. He was an Italian Baroque artist. This is where God reveals his name in the burning bush in Exodus. And you can see, if you see the detail in the piece of art, what he's doing is he's in the act of taking off his sandals. Because Moses is confronted by this burning bush, realizes that the God of the universe is somehow specially present in it. And he's like, "Whoa!" And then God's, like, "Who are you?" And God says, "I am." And he delivers his divine name for the first time. We were singing it, Yahweh, Yahweh. Well, this is the first time in human history where that name was uttered by God to describe himself. And if you're wondering, Yahweh means something like the one who is, or I am the one who, or just being, like existence. And so when Jesus later on says, I am who I am, they're like, who are you? He's like, I am who I am. That freaked the Jewish people out because he's claiming the name of God, Yahweh. I am who I am. I'm existence. Now, what do Jewish people do with this? Their view of God over the centuries, they started forgetting all the ways in which God described himself as Father and only remembered the stuff like this, where God is this far away, super powerful, sometimes angry, definitely dangerous and awesome in the original meaning of that word awesome, like awe-inspiring to the point of possibly terror. And the one that we better obey, that was their vision of who God is and was. So when Jesus says this, and back to the text, when Jesus says our Father, he is radically reframing the way we think about God. And that's going to radically reframe the way we talk to God. And the question is, do we do this? I mean, I'm just being honest. Like, it's rote for me now. Gracious God and Father. That's just how I pray. It's just how I think. But I wonder, am I really speaking to God as though he's my Father? When I was in Japan, I lived in Japan for a couple of years after college, and I was a young teacher there. And Japan is a very hierarchical culture, and it's very honor, shame based, and they have a tradition there of bowing. And so when I got there, I didn't know how to do it, because everyone's just doing this all the time. You're like, ah! But there's actually a science to it. There's an art, really, a science or an art, where depending on how high up you are in like the greatness of human beings, the less bowing you have to do, and the lower, you don't have to go as low. The lower you are in the great chain of all things human, the more you bow. You never go farther than about 45%, but that was me, right? Because I was the foreigner, their word for foreigners is gaijin, means barbarian. So I was not a barbarian. And so they didn't expect a whole lot out of me. But if I was doing it right, I'd be like this. Especially when I met my principal, my Kocho sensei, he was like the king of the school. And then he would kind of do this back. Like, get out of here. You're nothing. But then you watch and you see, like, as you move up the hierarchy, you're like, well, I'll do one of these. You know, maybe do one of these. Never do one of these. It's a perspective of how we look at authority, how we look at those over us, right? The last thing I would have thought about my coach, a sensei, my principal, was that he was my Father. Instead, I looked at him more the way I would look at, like, a landlord. You know, this was his domain, and I was just there, you know, by his permission. And so that radically altered my interactions with him, right? Like, I would never just go up to Kocho Sensei and be like, I need more supplies. Hook it up, man. If Kocho Sensei said something, I would never, like, negotiate or talk back. Be like, just like, hi. Onegashimasu. And maybe, for some of us, that's where we come from. Maybe that's how God is to us. Well, Jesus is saying, no, reframe the way you think. That's the first thing in your note sheets. We get to talk to God like a loving father, not our landlord. And the key there is loving father. For some of us come with really bad experiences of dads. Maybe some of us don't even have dads. Maybe we're not sure what a good dad looks like. And we kind of have to imagine that. But that's who God is supposed to be like. We'll talk about that in a second. But let me ask you this. When you're praying, and I have highlighted when in this question, because if you were here last week, you know you should be praying. It's not an if, but a when. You got to be doing this. When you pray, how do you talk to God? Like the president, like Kocho Sensei? You know, like your buddy? There was a sacrilegious film that came out about 20 years ago called Dogma. And it was directed and written by Kevin Smith, who grew up Catholic, now an atheist. But one of the things he does is he lampoons the Catholic Church, because in his experience, the Catholic Church was trying to make God way less like up there and way too much down here. And so it comes up with the buddy Christ. And it's like an image of Jesus being like, hey! And maybe that's something that we do. Maybe we think about God as, you know, maybe too much of our buddy, our pal. Because when you're talking to your dad, like you can be friends. I'm friends with or I was until he passed, but I was really good friends with my father. But there's a line there, right? There's a place where, like, oh, but wait. I'm your father first, your friend second. A business partner? God, look, let's make a deal. If I do this, I expect that you are going to return the favor. Look, I've been very holy. That's the contract, right? Like a lover? I've seen this. I've seen people who they're so intimate, I guess, with God that it almost sounds like when they're praying that they're speaking to not a father, but like someone that they're like intimate with. In fact, if you go back and look at some of the monks and the medieval spirituality, they have these prayers where it's like God is like, it's like, whoa, we are crossing into some really weird language here. But it's like there's this pure mutuality, like we're so intimate, we're just on the same page all the time. Someone we're trying to impress. No, we're supposed to be the frame, the most basic way we're supposed to understand who we're talking to is as a loving father. And what does that look like? That's the next question. What does that look like? What is talking to a loving father like? Well, there's a certain amount of reverence, right? You know, your dad's, when you're a teenager, you're stupid. Like, you think you're better than your father. And it's not until you're 30 that you realize, nope, he was the one who figured it all out. And along the way, you're supposed to be, like, there's supposed to be a level of respect. But that respect is in reverence. It's countered by also a level of trust. I know that this father is for me. I know that my dad is with me. I know that he's not going to abandon me. And so because that's the way, and I know he wants good things for me. And so it's okay to go, like when you're with your dad, you're like you can go to your dad and just ask for anything, right? Like, it doesn't matter how ludicrous it is. He might say no, but he's the kind of person where you can just walk up. I would never go to, you know, there's a lot of people in the world that I would not ask a lot of things of, but I can ask anything of my dad. Dad, can you please just buy me a house? Like, I'd love to have a house. And he's probably like, you know, I'm a history teacher, right? No, I'm buying you a house. But that kind of outrageous. So there's this balance between like reverence and trust and a continual dialogue. When you have a great dad, like how great is it to just pick up the phone and chat, you know, and just check in. So then, okay, so listen to the irony here, right? So first, we just explained Israel, the Jewish people were like, God's way far away, you know, not super close to us. We got kind of afraid of him a lot. And then Jesus is like, no way. God's way more close to us. And then what does Jesus say next in the prayer? It's very ironic. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Hallowed. Halloween. It's Halloween is, I mean, what does hallow mean? We don't use it in English very much anymore. But hallow is to make something sacred or holy, right? And so Halloween is the day before All Saints Day. So it's Hallow Eve, Halloween. Saints are people who are holy, right? And so the original meaning of Halloween was this is the day before All Saints Day, before the Holy Day. So if we look at that text, what does that mean? We're saying to God, may your name be made holy. We heard in the music this morning, how often your name is great. You are holy. But the prayer is saying, may your name be holy. May your name be made sacred. Well, it already is, right? Like you can't unsacralize God's name. God's name is God's name. So why the heck is Jesus teaching us? First, it seems like now we're talking about making him holy and sacred again. Seems like he's going far away again. We just brought him down to make us our Father. Now we're pushing him back away and making, and then why, how does it, what does it mean that we're going to try to make his name holy? He's Yahweh. The Jewish people were so scared of saying his name that they, like when they were reading, they put, the vowels. So it's like in the text, it says Yahweh, right? They put the vowels for the word Adonai, which is Lord, in between the letters YHWH, so that when rabbis were reading the text, they wouldn't accidentally say the word Yahweh. That's how much they revered, how sacred that name was. They would never ever utter the name Yahweh in their entire lives. Instead, Adonai, 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 Lord, Lord, Lord. That's why when you read the Old Testament, sometimes you'll see Lord in all caps. It's because underneath that is the Hebrew for Yahweh, but they want to protect that word. So why is Jesus doing this? Well, I suggest that he is still making God, or he's bringing God down, not down, but making us recognize how close God is to us. But he's also giving us a mission. This is a request. We're begging God for his name to be sacred. What does that mean? I have three things I think it means. The first. Wait, what? Did I skip some questions? Is that what happened? No, go back. Where's the go to the Disney? I want the Disney. Show me the Disney. There it is. Disneyland. Most magical, happiest place on earth. You know how they make that happen, right? They treat their employees, called cast members, not employees, as slaves. You should look this up. You should look up the code of conduct for being a cast member at Disneyland. It's like going into the military. I mean, it might even be worse. I don't know. Like, they have an very extreme dress code. You're not allowed. You can only, if you're a woman, you may only wear two rings. So you're going to have to leave that third ring at home. No loop earrings. You can't even say the word vomit. You have to learn this whole new, it's just like being a police officer where you have codes, right, for things that are happening. You can't use the word vomit in a Disney park. Instead, you have to say, oh, we have a code V. You can never say the words, I don't know. Instead, you have to immediately, if you don't know the answer, you have to draw the person, never leave them, you can never leave someone who has a question, draw them to somebody who does know. You have to look a certain way. Your hair has to be combed and cut a certain way. You have to be, they have certain sizes that you can and can't be depending on what your role is. It's really intense. Why? Because Disneyland is the happiest place on earth. And if you don't follow those rules, you are going to dishonor the name of Disneyland. If you do it wrong, oh, another one. If you're like Mickey Mouse, you have to learn the official Disney way to sign Mickey Mouse so that every guest gets the same looking Mickey Mouse signature, no matter who's behind the costume. Because if they don't do that, then the beauty and the wonder of what Disneyland is, it's going to fade. You're gonna start to break through. Disneyland's not all that special anymore. It's not the happiest place on earth. Maybe Knott's is. Similarly, when Jesus teaches us to say, God, may your name be made holy, what we're saying is, God, make sure I'm not the one who's out there dishonoring your name. Name isn't just Yahweh. Name, you know what a name is, it's your reputation, right? The reputation that you carry, that's your name. And if you want your name to be sacred or holy, then you have to uphold that reputation. The people around you need to uphold that reputation. We need to be making sure that God's reputation is not being dishonored by how we act. At Disneyland, it's no hoop earrings. For us, it's how do we make sure that God's reputation is upheld by how we live? Next thing in your note sheets, hallowing God's name means not dishonoring his reputation. A couple questions on that. Number one, what are the things about you that make God look good? Think about this. Every person here who's believed in Jesus, if you have believed in Jesus for eternal life, there is something about you, some fruit that you have, something about your character, your person, that when other people look at you, they're like, man, your God is great. I don't necessarily believe in your God, and he may not be all that you think he is, but you sure make him look good. But there's a converse, right? Maybe there's some things that we do, not are, by the way, but do, this is an action thing, that tarnishes God's rep in the eyes of others. Like, oh, you're not any different than me. You're not better than me. God's, that's how you act? I thought you respected that guy. So that's one thing that mean, that hallowing God's name means. It means not bringing dishonor. There's another thing, another way in which we hallow God's name. Show of hands, who here has an Android phone? Android. Okay, I want you to look around. I want you to look, because the next question is important. Look around. Okay, that's what? 8? Okay, how many have an iPhone? Oh, okay. Interesting. Here's something you will never hear, ever. Oh my gosh. My Android phone rules. My Android phone is the best. You'll hear this, it's cheap or cheaper. But no one walks around and is like, you need a Samsung Galaxy, my man. It's the best. I own a Samsung Galaxy. My family, we hate Apple. It's an evil corporation. Thanks, Kevin. So that's fine. You're just supporting Chinese slave labor. It's great. Don't worry about it. but I will tell you this. Every time I have to text for Aaron, oh my gosh, it feels so good. My wife has an iPhone. It's like, oh, I never make a mistake. The touch sensitivity is so perfect. It's beautiful. Look at that. Look at the difference between those two phones. One is like demonstrably ugly. The other one was featured in Elle magazine as a fashion, and it's the one on the right, like a fashion piece because of the mint green Apple. And the other thing I've noticed is that people who own iPhones, they can't shut up about them. Please stop telling me how great it is. I know. I've seen it. But every time you're like, oh, man, I can't wait till the 14 comes out. Boy, Apple's the best. Yeah, I get it. You love Apple. Isn't that odd? Isn't that odd that all you iPhone owners are constantly talking about your phone to me? You're constantly like, please, Tom, you can't be a part of our text thread in the right way because you have an Android. Hey, guess what? I don't want to be a part of your text thread in the right way. I'm fine where I'm at, but I know that you want that good thing for me because you've experienced it. You have touched and experienced and lived with the glory, the majesty of the iPhone. And you can do drop things where your phone automatically syncs to your MacBook and your iWatch tells you, like, it talks to you and you can read your text message. I get it. It's incredible. It's wonderful. It's beautiful. And you guys, you love it. And you can't stop talking about it. Hallowing God's name. It's making God's name sacred, not just to me, but everywhere. May your name be made holy. May the whole world recognize how awesome you are. May everyone recognize the greatness of God's name. Well, how is that going to happen? Because God doesn't usually, sometimes, met people who've had crazy visions and whatnot, but for the most part, God relies on us to make sure everyone else knows how great his name is. How crazy is it that you get so pumped about your iPhone? How crazy that you get so pumped about your favorite sports team? How crazy is it that you get so pumped about your favorite makeup? Oh, you got to get down to Sephora. You got to go to, I got the best. If it's not Coco Chanel, it's not a real perfume. We're so pumped about all these brands in our lives, right? What about God's brand? So next thing in your note sheets, hallowing God's name means spreading his fame everywhere. He's worthy. He's worth it. He really had, just as you've had this amazing experience with whatever brand or whatever product that you think is incredible, what has God done? God has transformed your life. God has given you new hope. You should tell somebody. There's a couple of questions here. Number one, what are some ways you help spread the news about God's brand? Everyone does it in some way. What is it that you do? I mean, it doesn't have to necessarily be words, although that helps. But what is it about you? Who are you? What kind of person are you such that when you're out there, God's brand looks amazing? Number two, and this is the one I think that gets us. Do you feel awkward talking about faith? I get it. I totally get that, and especially in this, you know, multicultural world where we kind of want to live and let live, sometimes it feels like we're stepping on toes. Here's what I noticed, though. When you're really excited about something, when it's really vital to your day-to-day life, it's hard to shut up about it. It just happens because you're seeing what has happened in your life. It's exciting. And so I'm wondering if we're having a hard time getting out there and sharing who God is and what God has done. Maybe it's because our faith in our personal day-to-day life isn't vital yet. Maybe that's where we have to start, is seeing God move in a very specific way in your life so you have something to talk about. Last thing, that hallowing God's name, making it sacred means, here's Aaron's celebrity crush. His name is Theo James, and he is a good-looking man. She confessed to me last night, we were watching his new show, The Gentleman, and she said, "Tom, I love you, but he's incredible." Imagine, so let's just imagine, so Theo James, you know, good looking 39-year-old English actor. Let's say that we're watching The Gentleman or Divergent, it's another movie he's in, and we're on the couch and we're watching the movie, and Theo James's character is doing incredible things, and then the real Theo James walks in the room. The guy, the actual actor walks in the room. Imagine if Aaron's response was, hold on, I'm watching this incredible show. He's like, "Hey, I'm Theo James. I'm Theo James. Nice to meet you." And she's like, "Shh, stop. Have you seen this movie? This movie's incredible." And he's like, "Here I am." And she doesn't have time for him because she's "This movie is so amazing." Isn't it odd that the creator of the world invites us to be in a relationship with him, and yet we get so fascinated by the creation itself that we don't have time for him? I mean, I don't know what it is for you, but there's so many good things that God's put in the world. But it's so easy for us to like get focused on the thing that's been created. You know, the movie, we miss the maker of the thing that's been created. We put the thing that's been created in front of the one who made it. We get more interested in the coffee than the one who made the beans. We get more interested in the sex than the one who created it for us. We get more interested in the food and the drink than the one who provided it for us and gave us appetites to enjoy it. How is that? That right there, that mentality, that is making God's name, his reputation, it's ignoring it. It's setting it aside. It's no longer sacred. It's no longer holy. It's no longer number one. It's whatever idol that we have, that's what's become number one. And so the third way in which we are called to hallow God's name, and the third thing on your note sheet, it means being captivated by his wonder and majesty, not just the wonder and majesty of what he made. Some people call this like falling in love with God, or, you know, experiencing the way in which he engages with us, and the way in which he's sometimes it's just reflecting on who he is, what he's done. But it's being captivated by him, by his name, not the stuff his name made. And I confess to you, that's hard for me. I'm a thinker, so it's really easy for me to like start thinking about, you know, God's nature and character, whatever. But the desire that's supposed to follow from that, the desire to be like, you are my God and I am your child. That vital living relationship connection, that's challenging for me. But that is the way, that's the third way that we can hallow, make his name holy. And that brings up two questions. The first, what parts of God's good creation have captivated you more than their creator? And number two, what parts of God's creation help point you to his majesty and glory? These are the things that they don't turn into idols for you, but instead direct you to the one who designed them and help you be captivated by his glory, his beauty, his majesty again. We're gonna do something a little different today. We're gonna have our closing prayer is gonna be corporate. We're not gonna have a song. Instead, we're gonna respond to this by together standing and saying the Lord's Prayer. And this time, when you say it, when you're saying these words, this is to God. Okay, I want you to think about who your father is, who your real good loving father is, and what he's like. And when you're saying it, I want you to think about what it means to make his name holy and separate and sacred, the ways that we do that in our hearts, in our lives, right now. So, let's stand. And I'll begin with the beginning of verse 9, and then join me in the Our Father. This then is how you should pray. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive those who debt against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever and ever. Amen.